I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our community conversation about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We're going to examine the ways RFRA affected our state economically and what it did to the faith community in Indiana. We're going to talk about what the lingering effects of the controversy are and might be, and possibly explore a way forward. My guests will be economist Morton Marcus and religion professor Arthur Farnsley II. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the fallout from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act controversy. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guess, we're going to be examining this from the perspective, two perspectives. One, what it did to the state economically, and two, sort of what it did to the faith community here, what divisions. We've got a couple of guests who are well-versed in these areas, starting with economist Morton Marcus. He was the director of the Indiana Business Research Center at the IU Kelly School of Business for more than 30 years. We also have with us Arthur Farnsley II, who is the associate director of the Center for the Study of Religion and American Culture at IUPUI. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks very much.
It's good to have you both here. Well, let's talk... I hesitate to prioritize because I'm going to offend somebody if I say that money is more important than faith or faith is more important than money. But why don't we start with the business piece of this and then talk about what it did to faith communities. Morton, what do you see as the impact of what the controversy did for the state or did to the state?
Well, it gave the state something it's always wanted, and that is more national attention.
But was it the kind of attention?
Well, that's a matter of faith as to what kind of attention is good. The issue is that the state of Indiana has had for a long time the image of being a backward place, of being a place that is not progressive, is not advanced, one that is heavily tied to the 19th century. And I don't think that we did ourselves any additional harm. All we did was highlighted what a lot of people already thought about the state.
So it confirmed in some ways the sort of negative stereotypes about the
state. That's right. All you have to do is try to talk to people in other states about what they think about Indiana and see what images they come up with and how positive or negative those images are. I remember attending a conference in Washington, D.C. one time and sitting in the bar, which is a place that most people go during a conference. We were talking about characteristics of different states. And when we got around to Indiana, the only thing that people could think about was the Indianapolis 500 race. That was what came to mind. Well, think about the Indianapolis 500 race. It started as a technological event, an interest in seeing who made the best car. Today is basically a race of personalities. All the cars are basically the same. We're not seen in this world as a technologically advanced state. We pretend to ourselves that we are, but I don't think that's the way the world sees us.
But to drill down, I mean, there were also, in addition to sort of that perception issue, there were some concrete results here.
I don't think there were any concrete results that we can really point to. The one that people talk about is Angie's List, deciding not to go forward. I think there was a grave doubt whether the Angie's List proposal would have been approved by the City County Council. I'm not sure Angie's List itself really was ready to go forward with that program. A great deal of this is speculation, and it is fantasy that people have. I have a quote here from an article written by a prominent journalist that says the price tag in lost business for the state stood at 9 figures, with a chance of approaching 10 figures. And some business leaders and economic conservatives.
Okay, so you're throwing my own words back at me.
Well, just one of the many articles I read, okay. Where people are putting forth as fact things that are only speculation as to what might be. And we don't know what might be. And I would tend to argue that we'll never know whether or not somebody expands or someone locates in Indiana or leaves Indiana because of this issue.
What about, though, Angie's List is the one they focus on.
Yes.
You have Salesforce saying, for example, that they're going to try to relocate people out of the state.
Let's see whether it happens. And it's the same way with, San Francisco and some other place said that they weren't going to have their employees travel to Indiana. Let's see what happens. All of this, again, is speculation and emotional response. We don't have any evidence about this, so I don't see that there's evidence that the other states that are in similar position have suffered adverse effects, and the states that haven't put through laws like this are somehow better off. Nobody's brought forth evidence that shows that there's really any impact of this. There is, again, the question of what does it do to perception. But as I said, this basically just reinforces what many people already believe about Indiana.
Okay. We are talking about the fallout from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Art, let's also talk about what it did in terms of the faith community. I think there's a perception out there to some degree that the faith community is defined exclusively by the religious right, at least in political terms. But that's not really the case. And, you know, what kinds of conversations were going on while Indiana became kind of a national focal point for a discussion about religion and the law?
Well, one of the things this shows us is that there are multiple faith communities. I mean, we use the term community a lot now because people want to be part of something bigger. And I guess we could say all people of faith are part of something, but that'd be something fairly ill-defined. I think one of the things this does for religious communities in Indiana is it probably removes some of the naivete about the relationship between religion and politics and economics. We sometimes think of religion as very personal and private, and of course it is, and we think of congregations and local communities. But what happened here was influenced by big national movements with organizations and think tanks and a lot of money. I mean, when Indiana passed its own version of the RFRA, a lot of thought had gone in to, from the point of view of moral conservatives, how to improve upon earlier laws, to fix loopholes, to make sure it protected the religious liberty they were interested in to the widest extent possible. But it's not like people on the other side who had more interest in equality of access and especially LGBT issues didn't know this was coming. So, I mean, it was set up to make Indiana ground zero. And I have the sense that, well, you have to have the sense at one level that our own state officials weren't quite prepared for that because they weren't able to frame it immediately as an issue like that. But the other thing is, I'm not sure faith communities were all prepared for how they were going to be tossed into the middle of this. And, I mean, it exposes differences in the faith community. But, I mean,
what differences did it expose?
Well, I mean, there are Christian communities in Indiana for whom religious liberty and the ability of individuals to choose would be of primary importance. And I think you'd say that was true because they're concerned that they're going to be forced by the law to do things they consider contrary to their religious beliefs. But that isn't everybody. I mean, there are plenty of faith communities for whom equal access and tolerance and equality of treatment for everyone, no matter what, was the most is the most important thing. And I think this helps to highlight that's only one divide, and we can't just draw a bright line, but it helps to highlight that. I think one of the problems is that I think there is a genuine tension, and there's going to be genuine tension, between religious or other kinds of individual freedom to choose on one side and equality of access and equal treatment for everyone on the other side. There are places where that's a genuine tension in American culture, and this could have been a time where we brought that issue up on the table and had the conversation about it, but it turned out it wasn't, that it was a time where the hype cycle kicked in and it became about political pressure. And that's what I was saying about naivete. I doubt this happens in the same way again. The next time something's coming along that's going to symbolize some major difference in values, my guess is Hoosier faith communities and Hoosier political leaders will be better prepared for it.
Why? And I'm going to ask this of both of you. Why were they so ill-prepared? I mean, we've just been through a major debate about same-sex marriage, the legislative process, where there was a lot of outside attention, a lot of outside, out-of-the-state money flowing in here to try to influence the outcome on both sides of the debate. We'd had a dress rehearsal for where this was going to go. Why did we not seem to learn a lesson from it? And I guess I'm asking that because this was not the last act of this drama. We're looking at probably adding, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity to the state civil rights statutes next year, which may mean we get another runaround of this debate. Art, I'll start with you, and then I'm going to give Morton a chance.
I don't want to put words into the mouth of anybody, and I certainly don't want to guess what political leaders are thinking because I don't know. But I will say this, at the risk of sounding cliche, some of this is about the echo chamber we always hear about in American politics, and that includes the political involvement of American religious groups. My guess is that family values conservatives were involved in a national conversation where they said, look, Religious Freedom Restoration Acts are being used around the country to shore up religious freedom and to protect people and now possibly even businesses and possibly even in person-to-person lawsuits, not just suits against the government. And Indiana's the perfect place because of our lock-solid majorities to tighten that up. And so in the echo chamber, that sounded pretty good. People on the other side, they saw it coming. And so because of that, because it wasn't a dialogue, it was set up to be a battle, to be a struggle, that in especially people on the family values side, and maybe people who weren't very strongly on that side, weren't prepared for the reaction from the general public and from business.
Morton.
I think that the business community in Indiana, at least the part that was willing to make some noise, has a national point of view. Eli Lilly and Company is an international firm. They're not focused on Indiana alone. And I think the business community wasn't really paying attention to this. People who are, I don't want to use the word more sophisticated, but more in touch with the world, probably couldn't believe that this would actually get through. And it wasn't part of their mindset to go out and oppose it while it was still in committee. We did have many people come and talk against it, but the business community wasn't out there in force. Arkansas is a great example. When Walmart came out, the governor of Arkansas backed off. If big business opposes something, particularly in a state like Indiana, it doesn't happen.
Although they'd done that, I mean, to some degree, with part of what what drove the same-sex marriage debate even before the Supreme Court ruled last year toward a resolution. And we may have to pick this point up after the break. But part of what the business community was saying is this is not going to be good for business, and that at least resulted in kind of a no decision last year, where they restarted the clock on the whole debate and waited for the court finally to weigh in. So in some ways, the business community had made its wishes known, and that did not seem to derail it this time around. We are talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act fallout here on No Limits. My guests are Morton Marcus and Art Farnsley. They are respectively an economist and a religion professor. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the fallout from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act controversy. My guests are economist Morton Marcus. He was the director of the Indiana Business Research Center at the IU Kelley School of Business for more than three decades, and Art Farnsley, who's associate director of the Center for the Study of Religion and American Culture at IUPUI. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Haru, welcome to the program.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I enjoyed listening to your program, and I recently have become a member of your radio station.
Oh, well, thank you very much. We really appreciate that.
My confusion is this, that I keep hearing the term the faith community. And when you're speaking of the faith community, are you speaking and are you including those of us who are not Christian? I'm a pagan, but you have people who are Buddhists and people who are Islamic and other religions. It seems to me that this is gearing around one particular faith, which is Christianity. And also, if that bill had a pass, does it allow those who are not of the Christian faith to do discernment of whether we feel that is proper or not proper?
Well, I'll throw that one to Art. I think I was the one who introduced the term faith community, and I was looking for a relatively neutral phrase to get into the discussion.
That's just you. I've heard that. Yeah, no.
In my case, though, that's what I was trying to do to try to find something that was as objective and fair as possible. Art.
Right. I mean, I would agree that faith community is a difficult term, and it's hard to think. I mean, you want to say religious people, whatever what someone might say there, that there are multiple faith communities, and they have not only different theological views, but they have different other social, cultural worldviews. I think absolutely the freedoms, the liberties being proposed here, if that's the way the framers wanted to frame it, and I'm pretty sure it is, would have extended to everyone. And I mentioned before, I think there's a real tension, and a tension we need to always keep in mind between individual freedom, including religious liberty, and the ideas of equal access or equal treatment under the law. I think minority religious groups in Indiana might have found a fair amount of extra protection under this law. They may yet, but it's now much more specific things they cannot use this law as protection to do. Because it's important to keep in mind that's really what this law was about. This didn't say anybody had to do or could not do anything. This provided an extra layer of religious protection, or protection if you said what you were doing was based on your religious beliefs.
But see, what disturbed me in my case, not just the LGBT community, if I walked in there, if I had a turban, or if I was Sikh, or if I was Hindu, or something like that, and a waitress or somebody would say, "Well, I don't believe in your values. I don't want to sell you my goods or wait on me and so forth." And that's what was concerning me because of that particular aspect. It gave the news media, I should say, gave the appearance that certain religion have a right to refuse what they're going to do because of their religious values. And it seemed like it didn't include everyone's religious values.
Thanks very much for the call, Haru. I'm going to let Art answer your question. Thanks very much.
I'll say this first, and I mean, I'm a religious studies professor. I'm not a legal expert. I doubt seriously this law could have been used to refuse service in a restaurant or someplace on the basis of anything, because people don't really have a defensible religious belief that you shouldn't be allowed to eat in my restaurant because you were this or that or what you believe in. That's different from the question of whether one ought to, for instance, to pick an example at random, have to participate as a business in a gay or lesbian marriage. So I really don't think this was ever going to be a question of that. And I do think that minority religious groups, and let's face it, non-Christian groups in Indiana are fairly small by comparison, that they would be protected both by the protections offered by the law, but also would have been covered their civil rights on the other side.
We've gotten an email from a listener named John, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. John says, do you believe low voter turnout was a factor in generating this embarrassing circumstance? Mentions that Indianapolis Star columnist Matt Tully had made that argument. Morton.
I think that low voter turnout is part of it, but you have to ask, why do we have low voter turnout? One of the reasons is we don't have competitive elections. And to me, the essential feature that's behind all of this is the gerrymandering of districts and the failure of the legislature to be willing to have an independent body decide what the boundaries are going to be of the various representatives' districts. There are some very simple procedures that are used in other states, Iowa, Washington, others, that are much more successful in providing balance in the districting of the General Assembly. I think that that's the core problem that we have in Indiana that allowed this kind of thing to just move through, and many other things that are going through our legislature that, to be kind, are fundamentally despicable.
We have gotten an email from a listener named Jerry who says, our regular listener named Jerry, the firestorm following the enactment of RFRA in Indiana illustrates the folly of attempting to defend an honored tradition while ignoring its substance. How could the proponents of legislation that seeks to define conditions under which religious conviction can trump civil law not think the measure would be controversial? To those of us paying even scant attention, RFRA was clearly a can of worms within a Pandora's box. Besides, the distinguished panel of Indiana law professors in the ACLU, many ordinary citizens, including myself, wrote to our legislators warning that the measure has ramifications far beyond their anticipation and therefore requires much more extensive deliberation than it received prior to enactment. The fact that RFRA passed through the supermajority caucus on greased rails, while unanimously opposed by the minority caucus, somehow failed to trigger any inkling that there might be big trouble ahead, does not speak well for the perspicacity of its proponents. Small wonder that there should be a public perception of a conscious effort to slip it past an unsuspecting electorate. Please comment upon the implications of this recent adventure in the context of what constitutes a reasonable expectation by citizens of careful and thorough deliberation by their legislators. He also welcomes me back. I was gone for a week. Thanks very much, Jerry. I'll start with you on that one, Morton, but I'm going to give Art a chance, too.
I think that the reasonable expectation of decent debate is wasted on the Indiana General Assembly. For a long time, we've had a General Assembly that does not reflect the basic, what I would consider the basic values of the people of Indiana. And it's, again, I come back to the business community. I don't think the business community on this particular issue and other issues stands up sufficiently in time until they can perceive that their own interests are involved. As long as business taxes are continuously lowered and benefits are extended to business, they're happy. And the social issues are sort of a sideshow for many of the businesses in our state, and they don't really come forward. I think those that did come forward during the hearings are to be commended, but again, there wasn't enough pressure on the legislature.
Well, they had staked out positions, obviously, on same-sex marriage, and then once they were aroused. They sent a pretty clear signal. You had one business after another saying, you know, if this goes through, if it stands, we're going to consider, you know, investing in the state, how much we're going to be involved. Are you saying that, you know, that message should have been delivered a lot earlier?
I think that message had to be delivered earlier, and I think it had to be much more public. I don't think it's sufficient to testify before the legislature. I don't think it's sufficient to lobby. I think you have to really go public. And it was going public by so many businesses so rapidly and with such strength that really turned the tide here on RFRA.
Art, I'm going to give you a chance, too.
Thanks very much. I have a pretty deeply held core value of myself when it comes to religious liberty. And so I'm a little iffy on the idea that an honored tradition, that this was defending an honored tradition while ignoring its substance. That seems to presume that somebody else knows what the substance is. And, I mean, the idea that there is a substantial, not to mention hundreds of years old, tension in the Christian tradition about definition of marriage and gay marriage, I think that's important. And I wouldn't be willing to just kind of push that out the door because there was other substance in religion that was about equality of access. The other point that I'd make there is seeks to define conditions under which religious conviction can trump civil law. There are lots of places where I think religious conviction could trump civil law. And in fact, that's the reason the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts first came into being, when it happened in the early 90s and President Clinton signed it into law. But they were questions about individuals. For instance, a Muslim man with a beard. In prison, state has a law that all prisoners have to be clean shaven. Does that law apply to him? He has the ability under an RFRA to say, no, that gives me an undue burden, and it doesn't get the state anything the state could not get in some other way. I wouldn't want to live in a society where every time people voted something and it became civil law, then we said, well, religious conviction can never trump that. I'm a pretty big defender of that religious conviction. A key question here, and we haven't talked about it much, is whether that protection can be extended to closely held businesses and to small companies, or whether it's just about the individual with the beard. That's a good question, and I don't have anywhere near as set an answer on that one. But I'm pretty rock solid on the idea that I would like religious conviction to be able to hold out against civil law in some circumstances.
Well, and I'll toss this, realizing we do not have a lawyer in the room, and we actually dealt with the legal implications of the RFRA debate. John Ketzenberger, who was guest hosting, I think did a very able job in exploring that with David Orentlicker at the time. But in what ways could a legislative act trump the protections that are already there in terms of the Constitution? You know, the First Amendment guarantees you the right to exercise your religion and makes it clear that the state cannot define your faith. So it would seem to me that there would be a constitutional argument rather than, you know, the statutory act here to say, okay, you can't trim my beard because this is an expression of my faith, and you don't have a compelling reason to override that.
But you know, I mean, the state's interest, if strong enough, can, in fact, trump people's convictions. For instance, you may have a firmly held religious conviction about using certain psychedelic drugs. I don't want to make this a big civil liberties conversation. And the state may have such a strong interest in controlling the use of that substance that it says, no, I understand that's your religion, but you can't do it. I think the purpose for the original federal law in 93 was that line had moved a little, and the state was able to pass laws without showing quite as compelling of an interest. And the point of the law was to put a little more weight on the side of the religious conviction and push back just slightly in the other direction. But it's reasonable to ask, do you get any additional protection there? But in federal law and in roughly 30 states, people seem to think that some additional protection was necessary.
We've gotten an email from Phil that I think somewhat addresses the point of whether this backfired, though, because email, Phil says what he, and he means Governor Pence, what he asked for, the right to not bake gay wedding cakes. What he got, the first church of cannabis, horse marrying Wiccans, the first state law to make positive reference to LGBT rights, and wedding cake for everyone. And then he closes by saying, Mike Pence, Indiana's most progressive governor ever. I mean, in part, did this debate end up going places that the proponents didn't want it to?
I think it positively did. And let me just say, I was on WTHR with the First Church of Cannabis guy, so I got this one covered.
Okay.
But, I mean, sure, unintended consequences were part of it. And I mean, the very best example of that was it's disingenuous for any family values conservatives to say that they weren't trying to protect the ability of people on the basis of religious conviction not to participate in gay marriages. I mean, it's clear mm-hmm. that that was part of the plan. And what they wound up with was the first codification in Indiana law of protection for the civil liberties of LGBT people. Now, granted, that doesn't apply to everything, but I mean, if you'd have told anybody at the beginning, this is what you're going to get at the end, they would have said no thank you.
Where does the issue come that allows the state to use the religious majority to determine the behaviors of all citizens? I noticed in the newspaper either yesterday or today that the first baseball game in Pennsylvania was played in 1934 on a Sunday, because previous to that it had been against the law in Pennsylvania and most states to have a baseball game. In Indiana, we, I believe, have a law that says there'll be no automobile sales on Sundays. Of course, we have certain alcohol laws. These all seem to me to have some kind of religious aspect to them, and that there seems to be no discussion of that. The Indianapolis Public Library closes on Easter. I don't understand where that comes from.
I mean, I think it comes from what was kind of the most widely held values in the community. But I admit it's a problem. And one of the things the Constitution does there is protect individuals who don't accept those wider community values. Real quickly, something I found interesting in this is you are now seeing in a lot of the conservative Christian websites a description of Christians, and especially these Christian small business owners, as the minority whose rights need to be protected here, which is an interesting kind of flip on the question.
We are talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act fallout here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. And first comment is I want to thank you so much for continuing with these the current guests, and I hope this will continue a public conversation of this incredibly, understandably emotional and now really fine-tuning, splitting hairs, legal, political, economic, that just starts the tip of the iceberg. Couple things. Usually I rant and rave by the time I get on.
Yeah, Margaret, we're getting a little close to a break, so if you can.
Okay,
if you can,
real quick, the question is, how do we, the state legislature does not listen to us. Going to them is useless. My own state senator, Scott Schneider, is a leader in this mess. How can you claim to be Christian and so mean? Number two, seeming paranoia of these small Christian businesses come from? And the fact that, you know, they're interviewed and saying, we won't comment it because that's not what the legislation was about. Well, how are we supposed to deal with this?
I'll
let you go.
Yeah,
I'll
thanks very much for the call. We'll take it up after the break. We are talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the fallout from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act controversy. My guests are economist Morton Marcus and religion professor Art Farnsley. Just before we went to the break, Margaret called with a couple of questions. One sort of spoke to the second one spoke to the paranoia, but also wanted to know what citizens could do about this. Morton, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, as an economist, I really would like to throw it to Art. economics is concerned with political matters. It's also an outgrowth of moral philosophy. And as such, economists feel qualified to talk about almost anything. We have to have citizens who are willing to address their legislators in their home districts. Going into the state house is not the place to meet with them. You really have to meet with them when they have town meetings. You have to have large delegations of people. You have to have petitions that are signed. I have often urged within the law a certain form of causing distress for legislators by parading in front of their homes with signs telling them to oppose or endorse certain legislation. You have to, in effect, take to the streets. And most of us are too laid back or too timid to be involved. I think that if people are really concerned about these matters, they have to show it. They have to show it in a way that gets them on the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock news, or whatever news we have these days. Make sure that that this is seen, that there are people who are concerned, and that they're willing to step forward and make positive statements.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Allison, and if you'd like to reach out to us by Facebook, you can find us at No Limits, WFYI. Allison, who clearly knows you, Martin, says, I recall many, many times at the quarter state economic forecast meetings, Morton proclaiming that Indiana would be Mississippi, but not for Indianapolis. I think the state learned an important lesson last week that Indianapolis will be what moves our state into modern times. The Indiana State Legislature, loath to give Indianapolis anything, has to come to understand that Indianapolis and the economic health of Indianapolis is all this state has got. Indianapolis will be okay. It is a city that has arrived. But the rest of Indiana, it is anyone's guess. Morton, I'll throw that to you first. I'm going to add one, Allison, if I might take the liberty of throwing a question. How much of this also sort of exacerbated that that rural-urban divide that has been part of our political history, to some degree part of our economic history for a long time, that I think also ties into the perception problem you were talking about at the top of the hour, that it reinforced the idea that, you know, there's little other than, you know, than corn and beans here in Indiana.
That's right. We fail to have a good appreciation of the fact that we have other cities that are of consequence in this state. The people in Indianapolis do not form coalitions with Fort Wayne, with Terre Haute, with Evansville, with Northwest Indiana. And we tend to think of anything outside of Indianapolis as being rural, which is not the case at all. Indiana is an extremely urban state. We do have some very powerful agricultural interests in the state of Indiana. Farm Bureau is a very good example of one of those lobbying powers. And agriculture is of consequence, but it is a very small part of the Indiana economy and certainly a small part of Indiana's workforce. Although I know my friends at Purdue take a different point of view that if you eat, you're part of agriculture. Also, if you're eaten by mosquitoes, I guess you're part of the insect world. The issue I think we have is to recognize that Indiana is not what it was prior to World War I. And how we get out of that, I don't know. We have this fixation on Milan winning the state basketball championship. You know, that is part of the mythology. It's not mythology, it's fact, but it's part of the legendary aspects of the state. We have to move on and recognize that the state is a highly industrialized state, has been for well over 100 years, and we're just not willing to accept that. And Indianapolis rejects the rest of the state the way the rest of the state rejects Indianapolis.
I want to get a point in here, though, and this goes back to Margaret's question about the paranoia as well as to Allison's question. I live in Indianapolis. I live right downtown here. But I would want to be cautious about the view that it was a rural-urban thing or that Indianapolis makes Indiana much different, or even the view that because of gerrymandering, and I will admit that the majorities get even larger because of it, but that if it wasn't for all that, somehow a different common sense would prevail and you wouldn't see things like this. I think that's just not true. I think that in virtually every red state, if you just put it to a straight referendum vote, do you believe small business owners, closely held businesses who people have religious beliefs, ought to be able to act on those, for instance, not to participate in an LGBT wedding? I'm saying that that wins in every red state there is. So I want to be very cautious about suggesting that something's being done to the rest of us by this Republican supermajority or this fringe group. I just don't think that's what's happening.
We are talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Anne, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you so much for having your guests on. I feel like if this kind of intelligent conversation had taken place in our legislature before RFRA, we might not be in this mess. I'm not rural. I'm not urban. I'm in Fishers here, and I just wanted to say that.
You're urban. You're urban.
Well, okay. All right. I'll take it. But
or suburban,
honestly,
definitely.
She's got a Starbucks.
Yeah.
I've lived all over the country, and this is my favorite place where I've ever lived, and I'm very proud to live in Indiana. But when all of this happened last week, I was hanging my head in shame, and the way that Governor Pence handled it on TV made it even worse. And it just really made me sad as a human being and as a person who's interested in seeing Indiana grow business-wise. It just makes no sense, this RFRA. It just makes no sense.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment. You know, that was a fairly common reaction, Morton.
Yes, but I wonder how many of us, and I share her feelings on this very much, but I wonder how many of us, although we hung our heads in shame and although we considered where else could we move, are actually going to move because of an issue like this. It comes back to the opening statement I made. I don't believe that people really are going to act on the basis of what has happened here in Indiana recently. This is a typical activity that takes place in Indiana. We are embarrassed by our state from time to time, sometimes more frequently than others, but we continue to stay here. There is a certain inertia that exists in our population.
But let me ask this. I mean, if this does, in fact, you know, one of the cliches now is that this is sort of the civil rights issue of our time. I think you can make a fairly compelling argument that segregation and other social policies, slowed investment in the South for a long time. I mean, there was a reason it was the poorest region of the United States for close to a century.
I have to disagree. Excuse me for interrupting, but I have to disagree. What slowed investment in the South was that the transportation in the southern part of the United States was not equal to the transportation system we had in the North following the Civil War. I believe that once we had the interstate highways being built, once TVA was developed after and was widespread after the Second World War, we were able to bring in air conditioning in the North and the South, but it made more of a difference in the South than it did in the North. The reason that the South grew are basically technological reasons. I don't think that segregation had anything to do with it. I don't think right-to-work laws have anything to do with it. I think that this is basically truly an economic issue.
So then is it really, you know, we've had Michael Huber from the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce coming in here and saying, you know, in many ways they were one of the first to do what you suggest, which
is
oppose this
and
oppose it forcefully. And he said this is about attracting talent here, that we're not going to be competitive if we are perceived as being discriminatory.
Believe me, I don't want to throw myself into it. Actually, I kind of do, but I would be unwise to throw myself into an economic
argument. The show's called No Limits for a reason.
With Morton Marcus. Okay. And in this case, though, we don't disagree, so I feel better because, if gay marriage turns out to be the crux of the issue, and let's not pretend that it isn't, it's still illegal in Texas. I don't think Texas is suffering a special ill effects from this. I mean, maybe that should be our motto. Indiana, still more liberal than Texas, but I don't see that happening in the same way. I suppose it could. And believe me, I understand the talent issue because we have this at Indiana University, too. I mean, that we want to make it absolutely clear, and heaven knows I want to make it as clear as I can, too, that we are welcoming to everybody and we're all about equality of access. But I don't think it's the only thing that decides these kinds of issues.
But is it a factor then?
I don't know, but I mean, that would require an enormous amount of empirical evidence. And what I hear about it is a lot of people's opinions that it is.
We are talking about the fallout from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act here on No Limits. Gary, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind?
Basically, I'd like to share my perspective from a little bit of research at an undergraduate level in Chinese philosophy. Religion seems to take a superior position regarding the behaviors of the Chinese from what I looked at, because they refuse as a whole body to recognize Chinese behavior as a religion. So that's a question that I have with how people can be welcoming if the religion can't even recognize other people's behaviors as a religion. However, there's the moral and ethical side to that as well. So morals being the less educated of the ethical position. Therefore, I concluded that that morals are less educated view of the actual issue.
Let me let Art get to that. Thanks very much for the call, Gary.
I teach comparative religion, so I teach some Taoism and Confucianism. And I will say, if your point is that religion there is, for one thing, it's less theistic, but also that it's much more part of the warp and woof of everyday life in less explicit ways than is true here, I guess I would agree with that. On the other hand, I do seem to hear in this call, and maybe in a couple others, and maybe I'm reading something into it, the idea that it seems inconceivable that a Christian majority could think that gay marriage is wrong and could be against this because Christianity is all about acceptance and tolerance and loving one another. And by the way, I think you make a pretty good case that Christianity is about loving one another. But I would point out, taking the kind of long view, that this change toward equal access for LGBT, we're talking about a couple of decades in the span of 2,000 years. Culture doesn't change like that. I mean, it's remarkable to me how quickly it has changed in America, but that people with religious convictions that are centuries deep are finding this change difficult and in some ways are disagreeing with it, I think it's to be expected. People use the comparison to the civil rights laws and the change for African Americans. I think that's instructive. But I think it's also instructive to say that that did not, in fact, happen in 10 years or 20 years. It happened over an enormous period of time, and there was a great deal of resistance, some of which was religious, and it took religious communities a long time to find their place and their balance in that. I would say for a few, it's still not absolutely clear. I think that's what we're seeing happening here.
Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. We're getting tight on time, so please be quick.
Okay, my question is, where do you see this going forward? You know, there are a lot of people who got together on both sides of the issue. Business came together. Where do you see this going forward in the next 5-10 years?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Matt. I'll give you each a crack at that.
I don't think there's any question that we will see the civil rights of all persons, regardless of their sexual orientation, written into law in the state of Indiana. I think that we will also see something that supposedly protects the religious interests of individuals as a cookie to the people who don't want to make cookies for the gays.
All right, I'm going to ask the sort of a refine Matt's question a little bit here, in that, you know, we are talking about civil rights statutes and all of that. In terms of where this is going to go for the faith community, what sort of examination do you see coming out of this? Is it just going to be man the barricades, or is it going to be take a look at what lessons should we have learned from this?
We should be absolutely clear, and I want to be honest that I study American religion, which means the overwhelming majority of the religion I study is Christian.
Yeah.
But among all Christian denominations, this has been one of the most important issues of the last several decades. We've seen Episcopalians butt heads over this, Presbyterians, United Methodists, Southern Baptists aren't to this point yet. But I will say, even with that, there are people in the evangelical community who are asking, of all the things we see as unbiblical or sinful in the world, is this the hill we want to fight and die on? Why this and not something else? I have to believe that we're going to see this happen in Islam. We already see it in Reform Judaism, that over and over, as the definition of what it is to be a person is thought of differently over time, religious communities will have to come to deal with that, no matter how firmly they believe their scriptures say one thing or another. It changes. If you look at history, it changes over time.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Art Farnsley and Morton Marcus. Also like to thank all of our listeners, including the ones whose questions we could not get to. We are not going to stop talking about this, so please come back. Like also for you to have a great weekend. We'll be back next week, and we're going to be talking about Indiana history. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.